again. Hi, I'm Jack Balkin. I teach constitutional law at Yale Law School.
Hi, Jack. I'm Eric Posner. I teach at the University of Chicago Law School. And today we're going to talk about the presidency in general and with specific reference to our current president and our next president. In particular, we want to talk about whether Bush has injured, damaged the presidency, whether he's made it better, and what our candidates are going to do if they become president. Now, let's start with this question. The question I wanted to ask you, Jack, is whether Bush has ruined the presidency. And before you give me an answer, I will forecast your answer. You've written about this in your blog. You say that Bush has not ruined the presidency. And this your blog post was very interesting, but I have to say I was greatly surprised, and this is why. You and your co-bloggers are well known for being critics of Bush and have argued that he's abused executive power. Now, when we look throughout history at other presidents who took very aggressive views about executive power, in all cases, there was a backlash. So even in the case of great presidents like Lincoln and FDR, there were significant reactions in the form, in the case of Lincoln, there was a congressional and judicial reaction after the Civil War. In the case of FDR, the 22nd Amendment was put into place, which limited presidents to two terms. And of course, the best example and the worst example is Nixon, who definitely abused executive power, and that led to a tremendous amount of legislative retrenching of executive power during the 1970s. So if Bush abused executive power, shouldn't we expect that over the next several years, Congress and the courts are going to take steps to reduce the power of the presidency?
Possibly. By the way, could you give me the example of the reaction to Lincoln? I know there are many reactions to Johnson, Andrew Johnson, but what about Lincoln?
Well, in the case of Lincoln, the Supreme Court in several cases after the Civil War rejected his most ambitious statements about presidential power. So the Supreme Court, for example, rejected the view that there were intrinsic war powers. I think the
which
broader
case are we talking about? You mean Milligan or the prize case?
Yeah, Milligan and the prize cases. And then just as the broader point, of course, the presidency after Lincoln was extremely weak up until probably Teddy Roosevelt. This reflected a general public unease about what Lincoln had done.
So this is a great way place to start. I think that there are several reasons to think that, although I think Bush has disgraced the presidency and brought dishonor on it, exactly the opposite of what he promised in his campaign in 2000, it's very different to disgrace or dishonor the presidency and to weaken it. My claim is not that he's not been acted disgracefully or that acted illegally, but rather that, in fact, the presidency will do quite fine after he's gone, and it won't be immeasurably weakened. And there are several reasons for it. One is comparing Lincoln and Roosevelt is actually, it's a good example. If you think about what the presidency is today as opposed to what the presidency was in the late 19th century, this all happened before the rise of the administrative and bureaucratic state. We now have an enormous bureaucracy that handles things like national security, domestic spending, the provision of government programs. And whoever the president is will be in charge of that very large bureaucracy and will be in charge of an enormous military, standing armies stationed all over the world that he can move at a moment's notice. Lincoln and the presidents in the late 19th century had none of that. None of this is going away. The bureaucracy is not going away. The military is not going away. As you and I talked about last time, I think that we're in the middle of the development of a new form of governance, which I call the national surveillance state, which involves enormous investments in technology for figuring out what people are doing and why they're doing it. But that's not going away. It started before Bush became president. It'll continue after him. And the executive is central to the development of that kind of state.
But we had all these enormous institutions in the 1960s and early 1970s. But I assume you'd agree that Nixon did not only disgraced the presidency, but actually damaged it, weakened its power. So over the course of the 1970s and even into the 1980s, the president had less power than he did in the 1960s, 1950s, 1940s.
I'm just not sure about it. I mean, certainly Ford was a weak president, and Carter was a weak president. But I don't think the reason they were weak presidents was because of Richard Nixon, actually. I think that we have to offer a slightly different structural account of what's going on. Ford was a weak president basically because he had not been elected by anybody. Carter was a weak president because he was the last president in the political coalition of the New Deal, and he is followed by a very strong president, that's Ronald Reagan. And so that's the second reason why I think, in fact, Bush is not going to seriously damage the presidency. Can I say a few words about that, the structural place of a president in line of presidents?
That's interesting, but I'm puzzled because you may just disagree with this kind of general conventional wisdom about what Bush and Cheney, or especially Cheney, and I guess Addington and people like them were trying to accomplish, and even what Reagan and Meese and people in the Reagan administration mm-hmm. were trying to accomplish. All of these people in the 80s and then in the zeros believed that the presidency had been seriously weakened during the 1970s because Congress had taken a number of steps to limit the president's power, including the FISA statute that's been in the news a lot, and the War Powers Act.
Right.
And, government sunshine laws that reduce secrecy. And, mm-hmm. So there are all these statutes. And the Reagan administration, I think even in many ways more aggressively than the Bush administration, tried to reassert presidential power, make very strong claims about executive authority in order to undermine these statutes that had passed in the 1970s. But it sounds like what you're saying is that in a way, they didn't have to do this. This is all superstructure. The presidents, after the destruction of the New Deal coalition, were going to be powerful no matter what, and we needn't worry about the legal niceties.
That's not quite the point I'm making. I'm making a slightly different point. So let's distinguish between two different claims. One is, can a president get things done that the president wants to do? Right. That's a practical question. And the second is, as presidents succeed each other in history, what are the kinds of situations they find themselves in? There's a very famous book by Steve Skowronek of Yale University mm-hmm. called The Politics Presidents Make. And these are two different questions. One's a structural question about succession of presidents, and one is a practical question. What can presidents get to do? Which one do you want to do first?
Whichever you want. I'm happy to follow your lead on this.
All right, so practical question. Generally speaking, if the president wants to do something, it's been very easy for him to get Congress to let him do it. So take, for example, surveillance. The president, for all that the Congress of both parties has complained about FISA, what's interesting is that after 9/11, President Bush asked for enormous increases of executive power through the Patriot Act, and he got them. Mm-hmm. He asked for increases in power again in the Protect America Act, and he got them. The next president will probably, if Bush doesn't sign a new version of FISA, the next president will, and he'll probably get something like what he wants. He won't get everything he wants, but he'll get a significant amount of what he wants. He'll get increased powers for surveillance. As for the War Powers Act, as you know, because I know you've written about this, every president since Nixon has basically said we don't believe it's constitutional, and the War Powers Act has never stopped a president from engaging in action overseas. Basically what happens is Congress just passes a resolution saying that for purposes of this discussion, this feature of the War Powers Act is complied with, and we have continued to send troops overseas. Presidents have come to Congress, as both Bush, Pear, and Feist did, and asked for approval, and Congress has given it to them. Anyway, I was thinking, Eric, that the real issue we might disagree about is the status of this very interesting and controversial Article II theory associated with John Addington and with David Addington and John Yoo and Dick Cheney, that the president can disregard a very large number of laws passed by Congress and the assertion of his president. And my view is that that theory possibly has been driven underground again and is not going to be used very much anymore. But as a practical matter, that theory really isn't necessary in order to have a very strong presidency because of the way in which the president tends to interact with Congress. Is that something you would disagree with?
Yeah, I would disagree with that. So just to be clear for our viewers, the theory you're referring to, the Article II theory, mm-hmm. is just the theory that the president has intrinsic constitutional authorities to engage in all kinds of things, roughly related to protecting the country. Mm-hmm. And that because this is a constitutional power, Congress cannot pass laws that restrict or regulate this power.
Right. And one example you might mm-hmm. is about with, for example, interrogation and detention, right? That the famous torture memo that John Yoo authored suggested that the torture statute, the anti-torture statute, couldn't constitutionally be applied to the president.
Right. And this is a bit of a counterexample for you, though, also, because Bush did ask for broad authority to engage in torture, or he didn't put it that way, but coercive interrogation.
There you are.
Congress has refused to do that. The Bush administration has come back with this kind of ambiguous statement that, well, you know, it would do whatever it thought was necessary to protect the country under the president's constitutional powers. The reason why I don't think that theory is going to die, I don't think it's going to die because it's been around for, you know, it's been around for at least 100 years. Mm-hmm. It's been another example, a bit like the torture memo, but not quite as notorious, although it was notorious in its time, was Robert Jackson's argument for the bases for destroyers
right,
plan.
Right, sure, of course.
During World War II.
Sure.
And, you know, Roosevelt made Jackson, who was the attorney general for Roosevelt, of course, made the same sort of torture memo argument. He said, look, you know, under Article II, the president is commander-in-chief. This is a war thing. However, fortunately, I don't need to rely on these authorities because the statute, which I will now, you know, interpret in a ridiculously aggressive way,
right,
in fact, allows me to go ahead and transfer these vessels, these naval vessels, to Britain. And this is a pattern in OLC and Justice Department opinions that one sees over the decades, many of them during the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. Reagan administration. And the president's lawyers are going to argue in the alternative the way lawyers always do. The Supreme Court or no authoritative body has really rejected this theory. It's sort of left out there as a possible theory that presidents will draw on in those cases where they in fact cannot get Congress to go along. What I guess I find odd though is, So why are you and your co-bloggers so upset with the Bush administration? And I want to be careful here. You have, you know, perfectly legitimate policy disagreements with them, mm-hmm. and any reasonable person can be upset with the Bush administration for the Iraq War or for certain ways in which the war on terror has been conducted. But these, you know, these Article II theories. In your case, and this sounds a little bit like Jack Goldsmith's book, The Terror Presidency. If your argument is, look, Bush could have gotten all the powers he wanted from Congress anyway.
Yeah, Jack and I are pretty much in agreement on this. That, I mean, parts of Jack's book I don't agree with, but Jack and I think are basically on the same page about a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, but what's the big deal then? Okay, so it seems like it was silly and a waste of effort on the part of the Bush administration to assert this the constitutional argument when they could just rely on or manipulate statutory authorities or get Congress to enact new statutory authorities. Mm-hmm. But that's not abuse of power. It's not abuse of power if you're engaging in what you could have done anyway under some other statutory framework, but you propose an excessively aggressive or even unrealistic theory for it, is it?
Yeah, I think, in fact, you're aligning a couple of things together. So, for example, suppose Congress could make it a crime for you, Eric, to engage in some activity. And then suppose the president says, well, I'll just arrest him anyway because Congress could have given me the power to make this a crime, so I'll just arrest Eric and throw him in prison. Right? Your objection would be, look, you know, you got to go through the democratic procedures. You got to make something a crime. You have to have the procedural protections of the Bill of Rights. All right? So in essence, a lot of the objections that have been made to the Article II argument has been offered have been that it's not sufficiently respectful of democratic processes, that it also has violated important rule of law protections. And I mean rule of law not in the formal sense that equal cases be treated alike, but rule of law is a political value, which is the idea that laws should be not secret, that they should be promulgated in advance, that there shouldn't be arbitrary discretion, that executive officials and officials charged with applying the law should be bound by legal standards and obligations. So most of that has been along these sort of political rule of law ideal concerns and also democracy concerns. Well, and by the way, I should say, in fairness to what you just said, Eric, there are some situations where I'll have a policy disagreement with the Bush administration, but if Congress gives him the power, there's not much I can do about it. Right? And there are some situations where I think it's bad policy, and I think there's also a constitutional problem. Now, in FISA, my view has been it's largely that he's violating a law because he's not been given the authority Congress has given him, as opposed to the primarily the Fourth Amendment objection to FISA. My view is the Fourth Amendment objection, there is some Fourth Amendment objection, but the major concern is the democracy rule of law concern.
I understand the distinction and your point, and it's a good one, but I still want to say that it just seems like the criticism of the Bush administration, again, not on policy grounds, but on this idea that he's this out-of-control, out-of-control executive who's disrespectful of Congress and the Constitution. But he could have done everything that he did, everything that we hate. He could have done it anyway.
Most of it.
Well, but this was one of your earlier points, is that, well, of course, a lot is going to depend on you know, how big the fraction is that he could not have done, right? I mean, if there's very little that he could have, if he could have done virtually everything he did, but he should have just gone to Congress first. I agree. No, it would have been better if he had gone to Congress. It would have been clearer. But if he would have acted the same in kind of, you know, pragmatic, concrete sense, the abuse of power has got to be limited.
Well, that's an interesting point, Eric. Yeah. Let me throw a couple of ideas for you and see what you think about it. First of all, there is one of the things democracy tries to do is by requiring people to go to other people to get their consent. It has the effect not only of limiting what you do, but also limiting what you ask for, requiring you to phrase what you're doing and justify it in particular ways that could convince other people. And it also has the effect of changing your own attitudes about what you want to do by being in this process. This is a procedural justification for why, in fact, we require people to engage in democratic lawmaking. Also, when we require presidents to get authorization from Congress for things, we also tend to put them under the aegis of rule of law values. So, for example, laws get passed, which often can be reviewed by courts. The Office of Legal Counsel has to go through the work of legal argument in trying to understand how the president should apply the law. There are really important procedural values that we associate with democracy and the rule of law that happen when you do this that get short-circuited if you just say, I'm the president, I can do whatever I want. And those things, in the long run, tend to lead to abuses of power. So I think that's what people are worried about. They're worried about the values of democracy and the rule of law being undermined slowly and surely through unilateral presidency.
Well, that's a fair point. I'm not sure I agree completely with you. I think what people are really worried about is that the president, in fact, will do things that he would not be able to do with congressional authorization. That is, he'll act arbitrarily, dictatorially, in a bad way.
Yeah, arbitrarily and dictatorially in a bad way, not arbitrarily and dictatorially in a good way. Whereas the argument making was about arbitrariness and dictatorship per se. That's a good point.
Well, I think part of the problem here is I think we have different. We probably disagree to some extent about what the president could have gotten congressional authorization for, and we do agree that there are some things that the presidents do that they cannot get congressional authorization for, and sometimes those are good things. So let's take an example from the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. which you've written about, of course. This is the 1999 invasion of Kosovo.
Right. He could probably have not gotten authorization to invade Kosovo.
We know. The authorization was voted down. Yeah. It was actually voted down by Congress. Mm-hmm. So he could not get the authorization. He went ahead anyway and did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is actually not that unusual. The use of military force without congressional authorization occurs over and over again throughout history. Congress usually doesn't try to stop the president afterwards.
That's what's interesting about the Clinton example. Normally the president just does it, and then he comes back and says, you got any problem with what I did? And normally Congress rolls over. Kosovo is interesting in this respect.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so Bush has done that to some extent as well. I mean, he went ahead and spied on people and then eventually He's gone back to Congress and he's gotten authorization. He went ahead and he set up military commissions, and then he was forced to go back to Congress and get authorization.
Which he did.
So this is a kind of a common pattern. Is there anything really? All right, so your point then is, well, he should have done this in advance. And I guess the reason why I brought up the Kosovo example is that sometimes presidents try to do things in advance. Congress doesn't go along with it. And then at this point, they have to draw on their constitutional powers, or otherwise they have to just make up some phony statutory interpretation, mm-hmm. which is even more common. And so all the benefits that you were talking about in going through Congress, well, we have to acknowledge that they're costs sometimes.
Yes, there are.
Sometimes Congress simply is not willing to authorize activities that are desirable.
Yeah.
And in those cases, when the president goes ahead and he gives a public justification and he issues an Office of Legal Counsel opinion providing the legal authority for his behavior, aren't these democratic values that you're concerned about respected?
They're respected only to a limited extent, because another rule of law value is the idea of being a judge in your own case. As you know, all the way back to Marbury, Marshall offers this as a key issue, constitutional value. And one of the things I think that many people have been upset with, let's go back to detention interrogation. I was just thinking about the McKaysey hearings the other day. You were following them a little bit?
A little bit, sure.
Yeah, in which McKaysey is trying to give an account of why he's not so sure that waterboarding is torture. And he's relying on a series of OLC opinions. Now, these OLC opinions twist the law, and I think Marty Lederman, my co-blogger, has demonstrated pretty conclusively why they are twisting of the law, of the definition of the anti-torture statute 2348. To show that they twisted it to show that, in fact, you could make the argument that it wasn't torture under the torture statute, so then you had to use the shock of the conscience test. Mm-hmm. Marty's point is that the OLC just adds statutory gloss that's completely out of whole cloth. There's just nothing there to justify it. And if you read
that's their tradition, yeah.
Yeah, and if you read the statute,
that's what they've been doing. Yeah.
Right, and that's something I think one should object to from the standpoint of rule of law. That is, what the OLC is essentially doing is, the OLC is not playing fair with the law, but is rather being the judge in its own case, if you will. It's basically judging on behalf of the executive branch. And it's doing so, it has to do so anyway. I mean, the OLC basically is in the executive branch, but it has to do so fairly. It has to try to do so with a relative degree of professionalism that can be understood by people outside it as being relatively impartial, even though it's part of the executive branch. And the OLC failed in this, in its construction of the torture statute. And I think that lots of people have every reason to be upset with the OLC for doing so, and have every reason to be upset with Attorney General McKaysey for buying into what is a deeply implausible, and I think morally heinous, interpretation of the congressional prohibition against torture. Now, of course, in our system, Congress, now the ball is in Congress's court, and Congress has to decide whether or not they want to do something about it. And if they roll over and say, well, that's just fine with us, then, then there is a sense in which the democratic procedures have produced this result. And I don't like in fact, there's a greater legitimacy in that case.
Well, why is there, so let me press you on this, why is there a greater legitimacy? The torture memo is actually an excellent example, because although it was leaked, it was meant to be secret, but in fact there was an enormous public reaction to it.
Right.
The elite lawyers around the country condemned it.
I condemned it. You defended it, I condemned it.
I didn't defend the reasoning. I defended the OLC's tradition of manipulating the law in this way. But no, I should say I tried to point out this tradition of manipulating the law. The OLC memo.
By the way,
when you use
manipulating here, do you mean you're manipulating in a bad way or just in a non-judgmental way?
Well, let's go back to, see, that's the thing. So you have the torture memo on your side, and I want to go back to Robert Jackson's memo about, so he did the same thing. His interpretation, so there's the statute that says that the U.S. government is not allowed to transfer military vessels to belligerents.
And then they have lend-lease. And then you have lend-lease, and the question is, what are we going to do about lend-lease?
Well, just to stick with this, so Robert Jackson, he interprets this to mean vessels that have been built for the purpose mm-hmm. of transferring, for being transferred to a belligerent.
Right.
And then he pointed out that the destroyers that FDR wanted to transfer to Great Britain had been built, you know, many years ago before World War II had come and had started, and so therefore they couldn't have been constructed for the purpose of aiding Britain. Mm-hmm. So it was a phony, it was a completely phony interpretation.
Do you mean phony in a bad
way? But it was justified.
Or phony in a non-judgmental way, Eric? That's what I'm trying to get on the table.
Yeah, it was correct.
It was,
that is to say, it was morally correct, it was morally and politically correct, and it was legal baloney. That's my point.
Okay.
That Congress in its isolationist mood, possibly thanks to the aggressive executive claims of Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, but anyway, Congress in its isolationist mood had all these statutes that made it impossible for FDR to give reasonable assistance to Great Britain at the beginning of World War II.
And it was crucial to give assistance. And
it
was crucial to give assistance to Great Britain at this
It was
point.
Crucial. It was crucial. FDR to his credit
mm-hmm.
and Jackson to his credit, mm-hmm. you know, the great legalist Jackson mm-hmm. to his credit, completely manipulated the law in order to accomplish something that was morally and politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you know, torturing somebody is totally different. But the broader point is about the extent to which the executive branch should go ahead and engage in policymaking that Congress has banned, based on its interpretation of its constitutional authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's fair to say that most of the time, or all, certainly not all the time, Congress will go along. The Bush administration may have shown grave misjudgment by pressing ahead with these arguments when Congress would have gone along. But the broader point is sometimes Congress doesn't go along. And in those cases, what should the president do? Now, all of these democratic values and rule of law values can be satisfied to some extent, but not as much. Congress is not involved, but nonetheless, the executive branch makes a case. You know, they make a legal case that people laugh at. They make a moral and political case, which might be accepted. Subsequently, Congress or the courts may or may not go along. But that's democracy. That shows respect for the rule of law, and you know, that's a part of our system. That's part of the reason why the presidency has become so powerful, because Congress is just simply not able to handle foreign relations to a large extent.
Mm-hmm.
In the modern world where we have this enormous administrative state and we have to deal with hostile foreign countries.
Right. I was wondering whether or not the position you're taking is starting to move closer to mine. Because when you talk about that's the way the system works. We have a system dedicated to democratic decision making, to rule of law values, and to separation of powers. And part of the point of separation of powers is that if one branch starts to engage in too much unilateralism, the other branches try to push it back into line, and unless they like, they approve of what that branch is doing. It's in some ways important, instructive to think about the relationship between Jackson as Attorney General and the Jackson who was on the Supreme Court in the Youngstown case, because one of the things he says in that Youngstown opinion is, well, whether or not it was appropriate for me as Attorney General to make this kind of claim for executive power, as a justice on the Supreme Court, I have a very different obligation. And my obligation is to try to decide whether the president, no matter how much he acts in good faith and how much he thinks morality is on his side, has overstepped the law. So one of the reasons, what we're thinking about from standpoint of institutional design, is creating institutions that can check and question and put questions to the president when the president gets out of line. I think that's the way in which we should understand the criticisms of Bush, that Congress should be holding the president accountable, asking him why he's doing things. The court should be there to require a second look. That's, I think, what Hamdan really is. Hamdan really is a sort of second look case. Those are rule of law values and democracy in practice. The problem with the president's Article II theory is that it tends to do an end run both around rule of law values because of secrecy and no legal standards, and also separation of powers values, because it says, I don't want to play the separation of powers game. That's really, I think, what's unconstitutional about it in the larger sense of constitutionalism.
Well, okay, so I would say, you know, first of all, there's this odd tension that we expect the branches to oppose the other branches. That's, you know, that's the original design. So the Bush administration has been doing, you know, in some sense what it's supposed to do, that is to assert the power of the executive branch. Mm-hmm. And maybe what we should be doing is blaming Congress or the Supreme Court for not pushing back.
You're not going to get
any disagreement. But you can hardly blame... the executive branch has been making aggressive claims about its power, you know, since the beginning. Mm-hmm. For hundreds of years, you see, you know, torture memo style arguments in litigation, in Justice Department opinions, in presidents just, you know, saying it themselves. Not all presidents, of course, right. But many of them.
Harry Truman made those arguments, by the way, in the steel seizure case. Not quite as bald-faced as Bush's, but he did make those kinds of arguments. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, you can't do it.
Not in these circumstances. But the other point I wanted to make is, I guess I have a less sunny view about separation of powers. I don't see any problem with the presidency gaining power at the expense of Congress, which is clearly what's happened. This has been happening steadily for at least 100 years, mm-hmm. And we see this both domestically, and we see it. With respect to foreign affairs. And as you stress at the beginning, a lot of it has to do with congressional acquiescence. In other words, Congress seems to be happy to give lots of power.
Congressional enabling, too. Remember, the national security state is put into place through congressional decisions. The national surveillance state is being put into place through congressional laws. It's not just acquiescence, it's also enabling.
And then the administrative state also, the New Deal, all of the agencies... Yeah. All of the types of domestic government regulation has been both, you know, enabled by Congress, although partly in response to Roosevelt's original mm-hmm. New Deal plan. But Jack, so this is the way I see the world, and I'm not sure whether you agree or not, but maybe I'm just being too optimistic. What's happened over 200 years, the presidency has nothing to do with what it looked like 200 years ago. It's completely different for good reasons. Mm-hmm. The country has gotten bigger. It's got communication and transportation costs have gone down, so it's more unified. Right. State regulation doesn't make as much sense as it used to. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for in a more limited way. So we have a much more powerful national government. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the U.S. has come into contact with foreign states to a much greater degree than in the past.
Yep.
Again, states are no good at that, so we have the big national, the bigger and bigger national government. At the same time, Congress has become weaker relative to the president because this this diffuse body of people who are representing, you know, sort of little parts of the United States in a highly disorganized way simply cannot deal with either regulation domestically at a national level or with foreign states. Mm-hmm. That's just the way the world has changed over the years, and we have to live with it, even though there's a kind of inevitable loss with respect to democratic values.
Right.
Bush is just one more step in this long chain of events. I don't think he's acted that much differently from other presidents, certainly not the stronger presidents. He's made arguments, and he's tried to advance them to take the president a few steps forward, but... You know, he doesn't seem that different. Putting aside policy, I don't see any abuse here. I just see a kind of a long-term trend, and it sounds like you see a long-term trend also.
Yeah, I think so. By the way, I'm glad to hear we're having a conversation between two living constitutionalists. Not an originalist.
I thought you were an originalist.
I know.
Let me
make an originalist point. In the Federalist Papers and elsewhere, there are two figures that are sort of ghosts hovering over the scene. And one of them is Julius Caesar, and the other is Oliver Cromwell. Julius Caesar, of course, because he smashed the Roman Republic and instituted an empire. And Oliver Cromwell, because he smashed the monarchy and instituted a dictatorship, and controlled by the military. So they're thinking, they're very worried at the time when they start about the possibility of a military dictatorship, of democracy degenerating into a military dictatorship. That concerns them. George Washington himself, the first commander-in-chief, was concerned about this in different ways, and he could have been the Cromwell of his country, but he didn't turn out to be. He turned out to be the Washington of his country, and we're all grateful for that. They had a belief that that democracies were unstable. That's why they wanted a republic. And they thought that democracies tended over time to degenerate into dictatorships. Max Weber, writing in the teens and 20s, also had this worry that parliamentary democracies, even in a republican form, over time would tend to become Caesarist. That is, the president would take more and more of a power into himself. He'd ally with the military, and he would use that essentially to push everyone around, and democracy would become a hollow shell.
Right.
And he was also worried, Weber, of course, was largely worried about the charismatic features of a leader. And he thought that modern democracies allowed presidents, much more than legislatures, to be personalities who could be, you know, plebiscitary presidents. And what's so interesting about our moment, if you will, is that we are increasingly creating plebiscitarian presidents, that is, presidents
right.
who rule by charisma and
right.
personality, harnessed to, as you said, as you were talking about, enormously powerful bureaucracies, military arrangements, intelligence arrangements, which in fact are completely opposite of this charismatic form of leadership. They're bureaucratic,
right?
And
right.
what's happening is both of these things are growing at the same time, the bureaucracy
right.
and the form of charismatic leadership. And both right. of these things tend to be anti-democratic over time. Your view is that these things are kind of inevitable. That's the way it's happening, at least the bureaucratic elements.
Yeah.
My view is, if they are inevitable, we have to think about questions of institutional design in order to preserve the values of the framers, those rule of law values, checks and balances, preventing of the exercise of arbitrary power.
What's so great about their – see, I disagree. I don't see anything anti-democratic about it. It's perfectly democratic. You know, look at the election campaign that's going on. Bush himself, once he became unpopular, he was unable to accomplish anything. His domestic program is in shambles because the public withdrew their support from him. I think the modern presidency – I think you're right to call it a plebiscitary presidency. It's a kind of – it's based on popular opinion and public approval. The framers, you know, that was 200 years ago. They had legitimate worries 200 years ago, but the idea now that the American presidency could become a dictatorship in any meaningful sense, that is, like the sorts of dictatorships that we don't like, I think that's – you know, I think that's even less likely today than it was in the 1940s.
I think that you're absolutely right that the wrong comparison is Stalin or the dictator or Mao or anyone like that. That's the wrong model to think about what the problem of liberty is in the United States. The problem of liberty in the United States is going to be different. It's going to be the rise of a form of bureaucratic governance, which is largely insulated and is secret and is isolated from public view, and which has effects on ordinary people's lives, and also a military arrangements which tend to get us increasingly into wars which are bad for us and undermine our ability to basically have a free society. Those are the problems. It's not going to be jackbooted Nazis breaking down the door. That's not the problem in the United States, a different problem.
Yeah. But I don't see, I mean, yes, I didn't mean to draw an extreme contrast in that way, but I don't even see the problems that you're mentioning. I mean, of course, these are things that we should worry about. But I think one has to make a case that, in fact, under our modern system, however you want to call it, with the enormous bureaucracy, and that it's actually worse, you know, because we could eliminate as you said, that under our modern system, that freedom will be maybe not completely undermined, but weakened, and that the government will act in a manner that is not in the interest of the public. I mean, the reason why we have the enormous bureaucracy in the first place is that that's in the interest of the public. Now, you have to make a kind of a basic choice. We might think that, as many conservatives do, that, look, you can't have a big bureaucracy that serves the interest of the public, so we shouldn't have bureaucracies.
Right.
So we should have very small bureaucracies. Or you could believe, as I do, that you can have big bureaucracies that serve the interests of the public. And if they are, the fact that the bureaucracy is not always going to do exactly what the median voter wants or whatever your standard of democracy is doesn't mean anything. It just means, you know, this is something that we should be concerned about. But having a big bureaucracy under a powerful president may be just exactly what we need, what is going to produce the best policy, you know, given the circumstances. I don't see any strong case for doing that aside from, you know, there are people who think we should go back to the past.
Mm-hmm.
That's an alternative view. I don't think it's realistic. That's an alternative view. But I don't see much evidence for the view that, in fact, here, let me give you an example. What is the single worst thing that the Bush administration did? I would say the single worst thing it did was invade Iraq. Now, the invasion
you
of
mean
Iraq,
the biggest mistake, long-term policy mistake and its consequences.
As a matter of policy, yeah. Now, the invasion of Iraq was debated for months. Mm-hmm. It had tremendous public support. Mm-hmm. The evidence, such as it was out there. Mm-hmm. Now, it turns out the Bush administration was wrong, but they didn't know that they were wrong. It was, you know, it had lots of democratic credentials. It turned out, though, that the people who supported the invasion of Iraq were excessively optimistic about what could be accomplished. Mm-hmm. And so it turned out to be a disaster. But it wasn't a disaster because the Bush administration or the president has become too powerful. It was a disaster because, you know, the way Vietnam was a disaster, because it was a policy that turned out to be unwise, and certainly with the benefit of hindsight, was a mistake.
Can I say something about that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great example. My own position, by the way, is not that we shouldn't have bureaucracy anymore or that the United States shouldn't be a world power. My view is more dialectical, which is if we're going to have these new forms of governance, we have to have equivalent forms of liberty protection built into them in institutional design. That's basically my view. It's been that view all that time. So, in fact, that's my objection. My objection is we're not doing the right institutional design as we build these things out. Let's take Iraq as an example. Iraq is an example of the president actually not respecting the forms of bureaucratic decision making that drive useful information through the system, that were put there in order to drive useful information to the system and to check information that might be vulnerable or incorrect. What the president did and what Dick Cheney did, I blame him as much as anybody else, was to route around all of these systems designed to get good information in and throw bad information out and check it. And he created his own little intelligence department in the vice president's office. And what they did is they shut out other people who had expertise, and they wouldn't listen to them. And they used bad intelligence raw intelligence or intelligence that hadn't been properly tested, and they used that to make estimates. And then they leaked such information to the press and manipulated it, and they also manipulated Congress. This is a situation in which we can say that the president failed because he didn't respect the built-in features of checks and balances within the executive branch. He went around them, and as a result, he got bad information. Because he got bad information, he made a disastrous decision. That's a situation.
Well, I don't.
Go ahead.
I don't think he manipulated Congress, but I think I don't think we have to be realistic. You know, within the range of what presidents do and should do, mm-hmm. I don't think it was serious manipulation of Congress.
What about the information point?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. Did you read? You know, there's a kind of a great in some ways and bad in some ways book called Legacy of Ashes. Mm-hmm. I think it's Timothy Weiner who goes through the whole history of CIA and says, look, the CIA, time after time after time, it gets everything wrong. Everything is a disaster. Everything they do is awful. Well, of course, one of the ironic implications of this whole thing is that if you're the president and the CIA says to you X, Y, Z, you know, well, what do you do with that information?
You go to the State Department and you ask the State Department, what do they think about your plans for Iraq? And the State Department says, don't do it, it's a disaster. And the president says, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. That's what happened.
Yeah, those were bad. That was a bad thing, not dealing with the State Department. I'm not defending the Bush administration, but there's actually a deeper tension here, which is of course very interesting, and this goes back to your point about how Congress. I mean, so you've got this view that that Congress has an important role of checking the president. At the same time, you have this view that, given which we share, I think that given the enormous changes over time, we have to have a more powerful president, certainly than the one that was.
We have to build checks into the executive branch now. That is, the old separation of powers isn't enough anymore.
Yeah.
We have to build a new separation, if you will, quasi-separation of powers inside the executive branch to make sure good information comes through, that ideas are tested, and that that sort of rule of law values inhabit the executive branch. If you and I are right about where things are going, the long term of history, we can't just say, okay, whatever the executive branch does is fine. We have to build it into the design of the branch.
Yeah, but everything we know about the history of the presidency should should give us should make us worry about this, and maybe this just strengthens your point. But presidents always, so Congress, as you pointed out, sets up the executive branch, that creates these agencies and creates these rules and tries to control who's appointed and so on and so forth. Well, for the president, the problem is he comes into power and there's this enormous bureaucracy, and he doesn't know whether to trust these people. They're hired under previous administrations. They have their own political agendas. There's no doubt about that. Every president thinks this, mm-hmm. right? And so what presidents do is they create these sort of new institutions within the executive branch. You know, everything's now in the White House, which tries to circumvent these checks. So Nixon, of course, right. and other presidents, Truman is another one, Truman distrusted the State Department. Nixon actually completely cut out the State Department. Right. Well, now you should say, well, so you're saying, well, that's bad. Well, maybe it is bad, but again, we have to be concerned here about the other side of the question, which is that the president is trying to accomplish something that the people in the bureaucracy believe is impossible, or even more troublesome, they believe is wrong, possibly for political reasons or for reasons that are out of date. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. This is just a problem. It doesn't seem to me that we can say in the abstract that the president should always obey these rules and so forth, because sometimes these institutions fail. They're bad institutions. They do a bad job, or they're good institutions, but they're disloyal and are not interested in whatever it was that the president was elected for.
Yeah, this is a very good point. But, of course, if you think about the logic of separation of powers, it's dialectical. It doesn't assume that all the wisdom is in one branch or one side of the coin at a time, and it allows the play of forces to try to produce a better result. So it may well be that sometimes the president is basically a doofus and the State Department knows what's going on. Sometimes the State Department basically is clueless and the people in the president's office know what's going on. But by creating an institution that requires them to basically struggle with each other and listen to each other and come to accommodation with each other, we produce a better result than if we allow just one branch to go unaided. That's the basic principle of separation of powers anyway. I was thinking as you were saying this about the long term. And so we have two different issues we're interested in, actually, Eric. One is efficient delivery of what you have to do, right? And then we're interested in rule of law values, and then we're interested in information, good information.
Yeah.
And we're finally interested in liberty, which is something that hasn't been part of the way you've been talking about it, but has been a lot that I keep going back to. I'm always interested as we change the institutions of governance to preserve liberty. And, of course, what liberty means is always going to change as you move from one kind of system of governance to another. And we always got to keep our eye on that, because if we don't, then we get a highly efficient system of governance that basically snuffs out liberty, and we don't even know it, until